High-tech scanners have discovered a baby Jesus that was drawn underneath Leonardo da Vinci's masterpiece, Virgin of the Rocks. The sketches were found by experts using infrared light that shows a winged angel holding the infant Jesus in a find that has stunned the art community. Professor Pier Luigi Dragotti of Imperial College London said it was like looking for a needle in a haystack, but such a great feeling to see the wings and head finally uncovered. Most incredibly, Jesus is actually invisible to the human eye and can only be seen using macro X-ray fluorescent scanning, which activates chemical elements in the paint. And you can read more about that story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. If you like what you're hearing tonight and you want to find out more about what I do and how you can listen to some of my other projects, go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. That's your portal to my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, my old podcast, The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone, the YouTube channel, my shop, it's all there, strangeplanet.ca. And if you register at strangeplanet.ca, you'll receive my free monthly newsletter, The Inner Sanctum. Again, it's strangeplanet.ca. Back to more of my conversation with Andy Thomas, the author of Conspiracies, The Facts, The Theories, The Evidence, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Andy Thomas, the author of Conspiracies, The Facts, The Theories, The Evidence. What's the climate over there in the UK right now with this kind of material? Are you threatened with being deplatformed and that sort of thing?
Yes, I think over here it's as bad as what you have there. Basically, the general attitude is if you believe in conspiracies, that you are, as we mentioned earlier on, you're psychologically damaged, you're a danger to society, it's all fake news and it must stop. And of course they're using a number of things now to shut down any conversations. I mean, we've just had an announcement here in the last few days that there are plans afoot to criminalize anybody that puts up anything that questions vaccination online. So that's now getting into a very serious realm. Well, even if, you know, you think you've got a concern that should at the very least be talked about, you could find yourself being prosecuted for sharing that information. Now, that's really worrying a lot of people because then it's, well, what's next? You know, are we not going to be able to talk about climate change? Are we not going to be able to talk about 9/11? And then the long list goes on. So it's a very worrying thing, and that's not to say that I've got the solutions about things like vaccinations, but, you know, to say that somebody that has concerns should therefore go to prison or pay a fine, that is not, to me, a sensible way forward. So, no, unfortunately, I think that it's almost as if that we're being used as a test bed to see how many conversations can be shut down in public, and it seems to be getting more draconian by the week. And the attitude towards people that simply want conversations about things the mainstream's not reporting is that they must be shut down. So the hope, again, will seem to be as time goes by that we'll be seen as kind of mavericks from the past that cause trouble, not as perhaps we would see ourselves, people trying to have important conversations about things that need discussion. But no, the way it's going at the moment is just to try to shut everything down.
We talked earlier about false flags. I want to shift the discussion to assassinations, which is another huge area in the conspiracy arena. And, you know, the way that the assassination as a political tool, if you will, has sort of evolved. You know, Henry II, won't someone rid me of that meddlesome priest, and which led to the death of Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And, you know, in those days, if someone opposed you politically, you would send someone into his bedchamber with a broadsword and do away with them. And then now we have sort of the advent of the plane crash. Anyone that goes down in a plane, we suspect. You know, if that person had enemies, that was an assassination. What do you think about the use of plane crashes as a tool of assassination?
Well, I think plane crashes, and often it would seem helicopter crashes. I mean, there was a Chinook helicopter that went down some years ago here, which had a lot of intelligence officers who'd been involved with Northern Ireland and whatever, all packed onto one helicopter. They were lost. There were many claims about that. And some of the soldiers that took out, allegedly, bin Laden, there were many claims and counterclaims about what had really happened with the shooting of bin Laden. Interestingly, many of those people all died on a helicopter that went down. So, yes, and you can list a stream of sort of famous people or people that perhaps were becoming a nuisance suddenly dying in unexplained plane crashes, but, of course, also car crashes. And this is the thing, is that it's not that hard to engineer a crash. And we know that the CIA, for instance, have done this around the world. If you run somebody off the side of the road at a certain speed, the odds are that person is not going to survive. Plus now, of course, we have cars and technology which you can interfere with their software at a distance. So it wouldn't be so difficult to engineer a crash today if you could simply just tune into the electronics of that car. But, I mean, the famous case, of course, of a potential assassination by car, if not plane, is Princess Diana.
Yes.
And those are theories that have simply never gone away, and I don't think they will.
Well, the method that supposedly was used to cause that car crash, a blinding strobe into the driver, Henri Paul's face, another car, you know, forcing the car into a pillar. Was that not sort of the textbook method that some intelligence group tried to take out Serbian President Milosevic?
That's right. There are precedents to this. So there were tales of a bright flash coming from the tunnel where the crash occurred that killed Diana. And we also know that there was a white Fiat car which was involved because it left its paint on the side of the Mercedes and then obviously had sped off. So there is one theory that there was a car, probably the white Fiat, a flash came from the back of the car as it was coming by, and as it did so, blinding the driver, it just turned enough to clip the Mercedes into the wall. Now, some skeptics say if you look at the sequence of the crash from what the forensics suggested, actually they say that couldn't have happened, and you know, we know that it bounced off a pillar at some point. However, that's the problem. Why should we necessarily believe the official story? And given how important it would have been to have found out who owned the white Fiat that might have been involved in engineering this crash, incredibly, the CCTV in that part of Paris was not working that night, virtually the only time in history. So the French claimed that they weren't able to trace that car. And yet, Mohammed Al-Fayed, now he used to own Harrods here in Britain, but his son, Dodi Al-Fayed, now he had died in this crash. He hired private detectives to try to find out who might have owned the white Fiat. And they did identify a man called James Van Dansen, who did indeed own a white Fiat. And although he denied that it was him, it is, I think, of note that shortly after being exposed, and Dansen was found dead in another car, there was a hole in his head which looked like a bullet had gone in. He had been decapitated, it would seem, for good measure. That car had been set fire to and locked from the outside. And yet the French authorities concluded that this must have been suicide. So these are the incredible levels of denial that we see. And indeed, the British inquest into Diana's death didn't see fit even to discuss James Van Dansen. So that's the problem. When you look at official inquiries, so often they omit the key bits of evidence, and they certainly omit anything that might suggest a wider conspiracy, which, of course, is going to lead merely to claims of conspiracy. So, yeah, there are many things very, very wrong about the story of Princess Diana's death, you know, and that's not even scratching the surface.
Huge questions also about whether, in fact, Henri Paul was, I think the British press described him as drunk as a skunk. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the problem with this is that the inquest did indeed, it concluded that he had been drunk. The paparazzi had been chasing the car, so he sped off. And because he was drunk, he lost control when he got into the underpass. So, yes, that's the official explanation. The problem we have for that is that there is no CCTV of him that night showing him drunk. He appears completely normal, completely sober. Not one witness said that he was drunk. And the blood sample that apparently proved that he was drunk was not his blood. Now, that was accepted. They mixed it up with somebody else. But what the authorities said was, well, yeah, but then we did other tests on things like eye gel, and he absolutely must have been drunk. Well, all we can say is there is no evidence that he was. And if you believe that toxicology report that says he was, he should have actually been so drunk, he shouldn't even have been able to have got out of bed that day, let alone get behind the wheel of a car and appear normal. So when you put that together with the fact that Henri Paul's family had been told by the people carrying out the inquest that he would be exonerated, that it wasn't his fault, and this was only a few days before the inquest verdict came out, but then when the verdict was announced, he was suddenly being blamed. There's something very, very strange here. It looks as if the authorities considered actually just kind of saying it wasn't him, and then realized that actually blaming him for everything was the easy let out, which is absolutely what they then did. But it's weird that that's not what his family had been told in advance. They had been told that he wasn't to blame. But only a short time later, suddenly he was to blame. So, you know, in a long, ongoing inquiry, you don't generally change your mind within a couple of days. So it looks as if somebody decided, actually, the quickest cover-up was to blame him. And so that's where it stands. But there are so many anomalies around Diana's death.
Right. Well, for example, we're told that she
believed that there was a plot to kill her.
Right.
You know, there's something which is simply not resolved here.
Right. She wrote a letter, I believe, that was sent to Scotland Yard, and I don't know if that it was revealed at the one of the inquiries, but in that letter she confessed that she feared her husband, her ex-husband, would fix her brakes.
Yeah, she wrote this letter to her butler, who was a man called Paul Burrell, but she had also repeated the same claims to her solicitor, Lord Mishcon, where, yeah, and we've got the letters, they're in the public domain. She claimed that her husband, i.e. Prince Charles, was planning an accident in her car. And she's very clear, and she even says, and the quote is, you know, serious head injury is what's planned in order to make the path clear for him to marry, well, as it turned out, a woman called Tiki Leg Burke. Well, Tiki Leg Burke had been the nanny to William and Harry when they were young. And it was Diana's belief that Charles actually wanted to marry Tiki. And, of course, Camilla Parker Bowles was also around. But, you know, in Diana's view, it was Tiki that Charles wanted to marry, and he felt that Diana was in some way blocking this, and that it would be too awkward for him to do this. But interestingly, a lot of people forget that Camilla had a strange car crash before Diana had hers, and there were claims that perhaps somebody had tried to kill Camilla. Now, you hardly ever hear about this now, but you can find the original newspaper reports. So one line of thinking thinks that actually somebody tried to take Camilla out first, and then perhaps having failed with that, thought it would look too obvious to try again. And that, in fact, the next best person to take out of the loop was Diana. But Diana certainly believed there was a plot to kill her. She had also believed that her bodyguard, Barry Manicky, who had died in a bike accident, a motorbike accident a few years before, she had also believed that he had been deliberately killed. So you can look at that two ways. Either she knew there was something going on, or, as the media view has it, she had become paranoid and was seeing conspiracy theories everywhere, and that it was just a coincidence. But when you look at the many anomalies and unexplained aspects to her death, it is quite a stretch to believe that it is just coincidence.
Right. The idea that she was alert, awake when they pulled her out of the wreck, placed in the back of an ambulance, and then the ambulance proceeded to crawl to the hospital, stopping at several points. We're told that, oh, this is the protocol in France, that you stabilize the patient in the ambulance. Whereas, you know, here you scoop them up, you get them in an ambulance, and you get them into the surgery as fast as you can, especially if you're talking about internal bleeding. So what actually, I mean, what is the protocol in France?
Well, this is, again, it is something which is debated. And what the protocol is today and what it would have been back then in 97, of course, it may have changed. But in the conspiracies book, I recount the tale, which, again, you don't hear very much about, which is that the French doctors, when she did eventually finally get to the hospital, they expected her to survive. You know, yes, she was badly injured, but they thought she was going to make it through. But it is said that in the middle of the night, suddenly the British doctors arrive and they take jurisdiction and they take over and they escort the French staff out. And then shortly afterwards, they announce that Diana is dead. And there was suspicion that these British doctors, whoever they were, had done something to make sure that Diana did not live. And one of the French staff that witnessed this was apparently on record as saying he was going to write an account of what he had seen that night. But then he died in a strange car crash shortly afterwards. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that are kind of very strange that build up around the Diana story. And it all does look, at the end of the day, like we are not being told the whole truth. But that's something that you realize. And I mean, in the book, I point out continually patterns where we are not told the whole truth by the authorities. And we're clearly not, right? And you can take whatever pick you want. But of course, then when they don't tell the whole truth, you will get conspiracy thinking. And often I believe it is justified to do that. And yet then they act all very hurt and upset when you start to accuse them of conspiracies. But if you are not straight about that evidence, you are inviting people to have to fill the vacuum in between. And that's always been the case. So whether it be JFK, the moon landings, 9/11, there are always aspects which have not been explained by the official account, which really should have been. And you think, well, hold on, why wouldn't you give the truth here? And so, of course, it's going to raise suspicions, and that's, I'm afraid, the way it's been. But what I try to do with the conspiracies book is to show these patterns, and you can see recurring features of all of them, and then the odds of it all merely being coincidence, it does begin to look less, even though, ultimately, I try to leave people free to make their own minds up. You can see, absolutely, that there are very good cases to be made for conspiracy in a number of strong areas.
Right. Well, one of the common threads, I mean, you mentioned the CCTV cameras in the Elma Tunnel not operating. Of all nights, that was the night they weren't operating. That's a common thread. Where are the security cameras for the Pentagon crash on 9/11? All of a sudden, those are mysteriously not operating. The security cameras pointing at Jeffrey Epstein's prison cell, those are not operating. It makes you wonder, you know, how stupid do they think we are? And then we have to ask ourselves, why do we keep falling for it? We will take another time out, and we will get to phone calls for Andy Thomas right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. And I will be back in the Coast to Coast AM air chair on Friday, February the 14th, Valentine's Day, and then again on Saturday, Feb 15th. But tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning, the lovely, talented, erudite Connie Willis will be hosting in the first half. Katie Elizabeth will join Connie to discuss her adventures under the sea with the Lake Champlain Monster, detailing an in-depth look into the mystery of America's Loch Ness Monster, nicknamed Champ, with documented sightings, first-hand encounters, and recent sonar readings. And then in the second half, the lost luxury White Star liner known as the Millionaire Ship, sunk back in 1909 with a lost treasure. Captain Martin Bayerly shares his 30-year quest to find the fabled treasure, including politically sensitive secrets and how rumors of riches beyond most men's wildest dreams were published in the day after her sinking and have persisted for more than 100 years. Captain Bayerly details his personal journey to uncover the ship's secrets, along with extensive research in an effort to substantiate or deny the rumors. That's tonight on Coast to Coast AM with guest host Connie Willis. Back with more of my conversation with Andy Thomas and your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Andy Thomas, and we are into the home stretch here on Coast to Coast AM. Your calls, not surprisingly, Andy, again, we've filled up the phone lines. Just before we move on from Princess Diana's death, I wanted to ask you about what's been going on with Prince Harry. Basically, you can't call it an abdication because he was, what, maybe fifth, sixth in line for the throne, but I guess he's living over here in Canada now. And I'm wondering, do you think it's likely that Harry and William know why their mother was killed and maybe who was responsible? And is that possible that has led to Harry's estrangement from the royal family?
Well, Prince Harry has been on record as saying that he has suffered from mental health problems, you know, because of the fallout from his mother's death. So now it would be inconceivable to think that he would not be aware of some of the theories. Harry is more of a wild card, as we are now discovering, than William. I think Prince William is more conservative. He's more likely to toe the line. But I think Harry has always been a little bit out there on the edge. So now I know that some people feel, or perhaps hope, that once Harry and Meghan have sort of managed to find a new life for themselves, that maybe Harry will speak out rather more about, you know, what he actually believes about his mother's death. But we simply don't know what he believes. But he must be aware of all the many anomalies around her death. And some have speculated that, therefore, you know, he just feels he can't contain this anymore. As a result, he can't carry on being part of this establishment that the royal family is, where he has to do everything that he is told. So by separating himself from that, perhaps one day he will speak out more freely about what he believes. I'm not so sure whether that will happen. I suspect he knows the bombshell that would occur if he were to openly start speaking about conspiracy theories about his mother's death. And if Harry and Meghan really do want a quieter life, so that would not be the best way for them to do it, because, of course, we would never hear the end of it. But, yeah, certainly William and Harry, they must know much more than they will ever say publicly, and they will be very aware of all the different ideas and arguing about Diana's death. But, certainly Harry and Meghan's, if you like, sort of, you know, they're running away, it seems, from Britain. It is something when many people are asking the questions as to what the real reason for that might be. And perhaps some years down the line we will find out more. It certainly caused a big sort of break here in the royal family, because the royal family, they have been such a key part of our kind of, you know, whole way of being. And we've had the Prince Andrew revelations, of course, his relationship to Jeffrey Epstein. That's been a big shock. And now Harry is leaving. You know, we know, of course, the Queen will not go on forever. So I think there's going to be big change. And for those in the conspiracy world who believe the royal family actually carries a lot more power around the world than we know, and I mean, there's also the reptilian theories and all of this of David Icke, but, you know, there is going to be a massive sea change soon. And whether it is good or whether it is bad that the royal family could start to lose some of that respect that they've had, it'll be interesting to see what happens to how the theories surrounding that evolve. Because certainly if the royal family is at the head of the ruling elite of the world, as some still believe, at the moment it doesn't look like it's doing very well. There is that evidence that it's crumbling from the inside, or that forces from the outside are trying to change that. So there are many theories around that, and I think we will see that grow in the next few years.
And behind the scenes, I mean, I'm wondering how much things have changed, if at all, over the last, I don't know, 1,000 years, when you had these dynastic struggles between competing houses. We had the War of the Roses and the Battle of Hastings. And you know, Richard III, if I'm remembering correctly, had his nephews killed because he was afraid that, you know, they would usurp him. Has anything really changed, or is that still going on behind the scenes? So, for example, we have, you know, maybe ancestors from the House of Tudor or the House of Stuart that are competing behind the scenes to gain the throne.
There are people that do believe that these kind of battles of old are being carried out, albeit more subtly. And certainly, I mean, like people that looked at the lineage of Princess Diana, connections to, you know, Merovingian sort of bloodlines, and you've got arguments about was this a way of keeping Stuarts from coming back onto the throne. Yes, there are people that believe that these things that have gone on for 1,000 years are still playing out today. Now, of course, those that believe there is an extraterrestrial bloodline which has been seeded around various world leaders, yeah, they do believe that the royal family carries that bloodline to a very strong degree. And there's no question that, you know, struggles over bloodlines have been fought very much in Britain over the years. Now, that doesn't prove that they're extraterrestrial, but it certainly does seem to suggest that it matters. And, you know, we might want to remember here that Princess Diana, when she was giving the very damning interviews on the television, you know, after she had split with Charles, she was dropping very heavy hints about what she described as, quote, the dark forces running the country. And she was making, you know, very kind of serious allusions about if you knew the real royal family, that kind of implication, which is another reason why many believe she had to be removed. But yeah, there are people that believe that there's a lot more to what we see, and that if anybody else has been watching the TV series The Crown, that is only half the story, and that there's a lot more that will not be shown.
Let's start the phone calls with Joe in Monterey, California. Joe, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, Richard. Oh, I love your music.
Thank you very much.
You have a great guest.
Thank you.
Okay. Andy Thomas, you're on YouTube quite a lot, and I've seen a few of your videos and stuff. I vet everything, and I do research, and I do debunk the things that I already know to see what skeptics say. So it's very difficult to separate things, truth from lies. There's two things I want to bring up. Are you familiar with the Tavistock Institute and the Church of Satan? And I think that would be enough. Oh, yes. And more and more research, more and more sources of information are disappearing very quickly. I've seen this continuously happen for many, many years. What are we to do about that?
All right. Thank you, Joe. Let's get Andy's take on the role of the Tavistock Institute.
So the Tavistock Institute is a think tank which is very established here in Britain. It's very open. It's not a secret. But it's about, it makes studies of psychology, and it has aims that some people think could be misused. And people believe there are deeper levels of the Tavistock Institute that basically are researching mind control and trying to find techniques with which the public can be manipulated and indeed individuals manipulated. So, yes, there is a discomfort about organizations like the Tavistock Institute and that what they might really be up to. But then to answer the second point, yes, you are absolutely right. Information that has been around certainly on the internet for the last 25 years or so, which we've all taken for granted will remain there, is vanishing. And a lot of information is being taken away from the public. And in the new conspiracies book, as I say, there's a great emphasis on we need to be aware of what's going on here. I'm trying to alert people that there is a censorship. And the solution, to me, is simply to keep that information flowing. Every conduit you can use, make sure we keep posting up the alternative information. We need to keep that alive, because if it does all vanish online, we need to make sure that when the pendulum swings, as I'm sure it will again one day, and people decide they do want to hear about this kind of area again, we need to make sure that information is preserved. Now, whether we have to do that through print media or go back to pamphleteering, maybe, but we need to make sure that we keep the information alive and the discussions alive, because certainly the mainstream media does not want it at the moment, and we could be heading for a world where the hosting companies are put under such pressure that not only will people get deplatformed from social media for saying things considered to be controversial, but I can imagine a world where hosting companies will not host websites even. And then we're into a very serious issue. So we have to find ways of keeping this out there, even if it's writing it down physically. So we might want to buy typewriters again and go back to that. But to me, that's the solution. And I know that doesn't offer immediate hope, but we need to keep the information preserved so that when the pendulum swings, future generations will find that still there, intact. And maybe they will decide they want to live in a more open world again where we can discuss this. So we have to try and do the best, but keep talking, keep discussing, keep sharing the information where you feel that people will listen.
Barry's in South Carolina. Barry, welcome to Coast.
Hello, Richard. I've got a great conspiracy story for you and Andy. But first, I've got to tell you, Richard, and thank you for becoming the king of the bumper music hosts on Coast to Coast.
Thank you very much.
I'm serious, and you might remember a few months ago you and I had a conversation about this, about George Knapp being the best, about identifying not only the title but the artist of the song, and you are now the best.
Well, that's very kind of you, Barry. Thank you very much.
Listen, real quick, was that a true story about Marshall Tucker being a blind man in Spartanburg?
That is my understanding, yes.
I'll be darned, because I'm only an hour east of Spartanburg, and I know the Marshall Tucker Band some, but I didn't know where their name ever came from. But listen, 19 years ago, the World Trade Centers were bombed, and George W. Bush immediately conspired with he and his cronies to not blame Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is too big an ally. So they had to blame somebody. So they picked poor old Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And 19 years later, Richard and Andy, we're still there fighting that war for 19 years. What do y'all think about that idea? And I'll see you, Jimmy. I mean, sorry, Richard. See you.
Okay, Barry, thanks. Quick comment on the Iraq war, Andy.
I mean, we all know that there were plans afoot to invade Iraq long before, you know, suddenly the reasons given, weapons of mass destruction, all of that came along. Now, officially, Saddam Hussein has never been implicated in 9/11, but it was insinuated that he might have been involved. There's no evidence to support that, but it was enough to get some people on message to support that war, because they felt that maybe he had been involved with 9/11. But certainly, as far as I'm aware, there is no evidence to link him to 9/11 whatsoever. And we know that they had to basically create the weapons of mass destruction story to give a reason to go in and invade, which of course then turned out there were no weapons of mass destruction. And over here we had Dr. David Kelly, who was a top UN weapons inspector, who went to the BBC and said, this is a lie. And then the government, the Tony Blair government, were very upset by that. They exposed him to the press, and then he was found dead shortly afterwards. And we're told it was suicide. But as you would imagine, there's a lot of grounds to believe that he was murdered, because he was saying too much. He was putting the British government and the George Bush government in a very awkward position. So the theories here about David Kelly, it's so strong that in all the polls, most British people believe that Dr. David Kelly was murdered and not that it was not suicide, as we have officially been told. So that all links in with Iraq and claims around 9/11 and the whole war on terror. And certainly, again, we can see time and again areas of misrepresentation. Whatever we ultimately believe occurred, we have not been told the whole truth, sadly, yet again.
That's for sure. Let's try to squeeze Linda in from Illinois, probably our last call. Linda, go ahead. Welcome to Coast.
Richard, happiness is when you're on.
Oh, thank you very much.
I want you to be on as much as you can.
Oh, God bless you.
Anyhow, I got a question. Back when Diana and Prince Charles were married, the story was that she would go to the stables and ride horses. Well, the rumor after that we got over here was that Prince Harry did not belong to Charles, and they had a picture of the guy at the stables and Harry side by side, and honest, they were identical. And so they wanted to do a DNA, and Charles and them refused to do it to prove that Harry does not belong to Charles. He belongs to the guy in the stables. Have you heard that?
Well, the man that we're talking about here is a man called James Hewitt. And yes, a number of people in Britain have said that James Hewitt is really the father of Prince Harry. And I mean, certainly there do seem to be some physical resemblances, although others have said you look at other pictures and he does look more like Charles. If, though, it were the case that he did have another father and that actually he knew that, again, that might possibly explain why Harry is deciding to go rogue at the moment and take himself away from the royal family. But without a DNA test, which I doubt that they will ever consent to, I don't think we're ever going to know that for sure. But yes, there are many people, certainly in Britain, that believe that James Hewitt is really his father, which is a classic conspiracy theory. But proving it, that is going to be much more difficult. But it's certainly the case that Diana did have a relationship with Hewitt, which, you know, is not denied. But whether Harry was the product of that, I doubt that we will ever know for certain.
Linda, thank you for that. How do we get a copy of Conspiracies, the Facts, the Theories, the Evidence, Andy?
So it's out there on Amazon. You should be able to get it through all good booksellers. It's out in America, Britain, and Australia, all the English-speaking world. So look it up on Amazon. That would be a good starting point. Any information about it and about myself, and you can find videos about me, go to my website, which is truthagenda.org. It's truthagenda.org, and you can find out about the book Conspiracies and my other books, and there's a lot of information up there. But, yeah, anybody out there that can spread the word about these areas, we need to. We need to keep these discussions alive, so do what you can.
Andy, thank you so much. A real pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Michael Cozio, Donna Walker, Chris Burrows, Sean Latasur, and here in Toronto, Mike Ben Dixon, Robert Turner, Patrick Neal, Alex Gulch. And in Brantford, Ontario, Scott Guitar Flicks. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.